MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
It's come around already. It's that time of a Tuesday afternoon when we say hello to Dr. Ross Walker. G'day, Ross.
G'day, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
Likewise. I trust you well.
Oh, very well. Yeah, life's good.
Life is good.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yep. A couple of questions for you. This one is from Elaine. Elaine said, I was interested to hear Brent talking to Dr. Ross. I believe I'm fairly healthy, but have shown elevated ESR and CRP tests. Could this be the result of long COVID? Prednisone appears to be reducing the levels, but I heard Dr. Walker talking about Celebrex. Could this help?
Look, firstly, you've got to find out what the cause is, whether it is long COVID or not. Does Elaine have other symptoms? Is she getting brain fog? Is she getting fatigue? Is she getting short of breath? All of those things. But there can be other causes for an elevated ESR and hsCRP. So I don't know how old Elaine is, but typically when people get over, especially 65, there's a condition called polymyalgia rheumatica, where you get stiffness in the proximal muscles, in the around the shoulder girdle, around the hips, and you wake up in the morning, you can hardly get out of bed, and it's an autoimmune condition that affects the small arteries going into the muscles, and we can also cause a thing called temporal arteritis, and that needs specific therapy for a while, typically prednisone, but prednisone for a prolonged period of time, not just till you get over the symptoms. So I think what Elaine needs is a diagnosis rather than just say, oh, could it be long COVID? She needs a thorough workup to make sure there's no other conditions causing this, and then we could take it from there.
Thank you.
And also, by the way, can I just finish off? It also depends on the level of hsCRP. So just say, for example, the CRP is only 10, normal is 0 to 5. If it's only 10, that's not much inflammation. But I've seen people who get acute COVID or acute influenza get CRPs above 300, pneumonia above 200, severe autoimmune disease, 100, 150. So it really depends on the level of these chemicals, the ESR and the CRP as well.
This is from Joanne. She says that her husband has a bovine aortic valve, and I'm sure that his surgeon told him he was not to take Panadeine Forte and only use Panadol. She said he has a hip and knee issue at the moment, and the GP has prescribed Panadeine Forte Fort for the pain at night. I am not keen on him taking that medication in case it affects his valve, but I don't want him to suffer from the pain. Maybe Dr. Ross has an opinion he'd like to offer.
Well, firstly, I've not actually heard that Panadeine Forte can interact with bovine aortic valves. It's the first one on me, and I've heard of these things. So I can't see what the issue is with putting a bit of codeine in somebody who's got a lot of pain. I mean, I don't think anyone should be using these things all the time because codeine is a weak narcotic. It is somewhat addictive if you use it too often. But if he's using it for chronic pain, I don't think Panadeine Forte's the answer. And we mentioned before, and Elaine asked the question about Celebrex. Celebrex is a very good non-specific anti-inflammatory that's pretty safe. It's much safer than things like taking chronic Voltaren or Buprenorphine or Indocid. So I'd prefer Joanne's husband to trial something like Celebrex when he has bad pain, and that will help from there. But again, if people have severe pain in their knee, the best treatment of osteoarthritis of the knee is what I had done, which is a knee replacement. But a knee replacement is a huge thing. It's not something you want to undertake unless you're in severe pain and things aren't getting, there's nothing else is working. And I had, before I had my knee replacement, as you know, I had a couple of bouts of stem cell therapy, didn't do a thing. I had PRP therapy where they take spin down your own platelets and inject it back in the knee, gave me partial relief. So I tried everything before I had to have the knee replacement, but it's been the thing that's given me my life back.
Fantastic. There you go, Joanne. I hope that answers your questions. Okay, let me ask you about 8 healthy habits that may add 24 years to your lifespan, because I'm thinking that makes me, I'm doing all right. 8 lifestyle habits and 6 chemical cocktails to prolong your life. Now, I can have a guess at what the 8 lifestyle habits are.
Well, can I say, these 8 lifestyle habits are just really extensions of my 5 keys to being healthy. So number 1 has 3 in 1. It's just having no addiction. So number one is don't smoke, don't drink too much grog, and don't be addicted to opioids. So that's three of the first one. The second one is good quality sleep, which I talk about all the time. The third one is good quality nutrition, eat less food, eat more natural food. The fourth one is 3 to 5 hours every week of exercise. And the final one, which gives two in one, basically, is happiness, which I talk about all the time. So it's good stress management and having good relationships with people. Now, you've heard me say this 1,000 times over the many years I've had the pleasure of your company. And so the five keys of being healthy, and if you want to extend them to these eight principles, has been shown if people start this at age 40, it gives them 24 extra years. But I don't think it's ever too late to start. Whether you're 80, whether you're 20, everyone should be following the five keys of being healthy. And I think it's very important. Now, secondly, you mentioned the six small molecules. Now, in 2006, a fellow who was a scientist in Japan called Professor Yamanaka discovered that he could turn normal cells back into induced pluripotent stem cells. And he got the Nobel Prize in 2012 with another gentleman, Ford, for this discovery. So he had these four factors called Yamanaka factors. And the Yamanaka factors have been shown to be able to give you back healthy, vibrant stem cells from normal cells. So it's called de-differentiation of cells. But interestingly, Professor David Sinclair, who's the world anti-aging guru, so he grew up around the corner from where I'm sitting at the moment in Linfield, and he's now the world anti-aging guru in Harvard, and he's done this study in his laboratory there where he's given six chemical cocktails, some of them switch on these Yamanaka factors, to human cell lines, L-I-N-E-S, not L-I-O-N-S. So human cell lines. And one was a 28-year-old donor, another one was a 94-year-old donor who just gave their cells, and another one was a child with a thing called progeria. And progeria is where you see these kids who look like they're about 50 or 60 and they're only about 10 or 11, so it's a rapid aging disease. And when he gave a combination or one, two, three, four, or all of these different cocktails, which were part of these were Yamanaka factors, some of these were other things, he actually reversed the aging process by 3 years with 4 days of therapy on these cells. Now, it's pretty amazing stuff, but you can't say, oh, let me go to the local clinic and get this stuff yet, because this is only done in human cell lines, not in human beings. And the problem is, if you take isolated cells and treat them, you don't always get the same reaction than if something's in a tissue or an organ where you want to see the effect on the entire structure. So the next step would be to do exactly the same thing in animals who are geared for the aging process or just in their different cell lines, and then move on to human studies to make sure it's safe in humans and that it's effective in humans. But it's pretty exciting that we've got already lifestyle things we can do anyhow, and all of us should be doing it, and tragically less than 10% of people are doing the five keys of being healthy. But there's also the potential for the relatively near future to bring in these molecules that will also help assist reversing the aging process. Exciting stuff.
If you're 65, is yep. there really a legitimate test that can tell the true age of your body? You may be 65, yep. but you might have the body of a 60-year-old
or a
70-year-old.
Yeah, and there's a whole lot of labs around the world that are working on this. There's a thing called the methylation clock. And this methylation clock looks at the epigenetic marks on your DNA. So it's not the actual mutations in the DNA, but the support structures for the DNA, which have been damaged. So it's a bit like you've got a you remember the old records, the vinyl records that get scratches on them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit like the scratches make the fidelity of the sound worse. And this is what's happening to our DNA. The DNA itself hasn't changed. You've still got the same song, but there's scratches all through it, and that's the epigenetic marks. And so this methylation clock measures how old your cells are. So they're trying to make this a clinical thing. So there are some labs that are offering things like that. You can get an estimation of your vascular health, which is a good marker for what your general health is. So yes, this will be, I think, commonplace over the next few years that we are able to get an indication of what somebody's age is. As I said, we can already do vascular age, but general age, yes, there are markers that are coming through and will be clinically available.
You've talked about this before. Do you have a crystal ball there? Give me some form of time frame, if it's possible. We're talking about, particularly in reference to vitamins and minerals, rather than taking, 20 tablets a day or maybe even more. Do you see it being not too far in the distant future where you just take one or two tablets a day and it covers all of those 20 vitamins and minerals?
Yeah, I do, and it's all to do with nanotechnology. We already have the technology, but if we had some clever company that wanted to get on board with this, it's just a very tedious thing. So there's the Boltitude script. So you go in and you might be taking three or four pharmaceuticals and you're taking 10 supplements or whatever, and you go into the pharmacy and they put the script into the machine or the computer, and the computer just goes, they've got a little wall that just goes and pulls out each thing, and by nanotechnology puts it all into just one pill. But the reason why, for example, an omega-3 pill is really big and hard for some people to swallow is because there's 1,000 milligrams of fish oil in that capsule, so it's a big capsule. With nanotechnology, you can take that 1,000 milligrams and just squeeze it into a few little dots that you can whack in a pill with a whole lot of other things. So that's where we're moving towards. The technology is already there. It just needs to be refined so we can get what is obviously called personalized medicine.
We're talking about meat allergies now. Look, I understand that. I thought meat allergies were called veganism or vegetarianism. That might have been a meat allergy. But now, nearly what they say that Lyme disease in humans, new research suggests that it could also trigger a serious meat allergy.
Yeah. No, well, vegetarianism and veganism is a decision. It's not an allergy.
I know. Ross. For God's sake.
I was just joking.
Just joking, Digger. Just joking.
Yeah. No, but this is a really interesting thing called tick-borne meat allergy syndrome. And it's estimated that probably 500,000 people in the US have this condition. And the reason why it's relevant to us here is that on the northern beaches of Sydney, there is a bit of a mini epidemic of this tick-borne meat allergy syndrome. They have a huge amount of ticks on the northern beaches. And I've got a friend who's actually got this condition. You get bitten by the tick. The tick then induces this weird allergic reaction to a thing called alpha-galactose, which is one of the sugars that's very commonly found in pork, beef, rabbit, lamb, venison, and also products made from gelatin. Now, why that's important is that we've just been speaking about it. Many capsules that are used for supplements and pills have a gelatin base.
Yeah.
And also cow's milk, milk products, and other some pharmaceuticals for a similar reason. And if these people with this tick-borne meat allergy syndrome have any of this stuff, they can have symptoms such as hives, nausea, vomiting, heartburn, diarrhea, cough, shortness of breath, drop their blood pressure, swelling of their lips, their throat, their tongue, their eyelids, a couple of hours after they've been exposed. So, unfortunately, there is no medical therapy for this. The only way to stop this is avoiding the substance. And so it really restricts people's lives, the things they have to do if they have this dreadful condition.
My goodness. Imagine being a meat lover, not being able to go through life and have meat. I suppose, like everything else, you get used to it, don't you?
You do get used to it, but it's still a huge imposition on your life.
Gene therapy. Now, we're talking about gene therapy being used for people that suffer chronic pain.
And a lot of people don't realise this, but 1 in 5 Australians have some sort of chronic pain syndrome, whether that be what we spoke about before, whether it be arthritis, whether it be recurrent headaches, whether it be irritable bowel syndrome, whether it be lower back pain. But there are so many people in our country who suffer severe chronic pain. And for people where it is severe, it's very disabling. And so at the moment, what some of the therapies we're offering are things like medical cannabis, and I always have to say it, I'm on the board of a company that's developing around the world, the opioids, which is something you don't want to use for chronic pain for obvious reasons of addiction. Then there's things like Lyrica, and another thing called gabapentin. There's amitriptyline, and then there's the mechanical therapies that many people have for chronic pain as well. But this really interesting study has found that a lot of the chronic pain is mediated through what's called the sodium channels in the nerves. So a lot of people don't realize this, but every time there's any nervous impulse, so you feel a touch on the back of your hand, it goes over to the opposite side of the brain where it registers that touch. It has to do that by traveling very quickly up the nerve to that side of the brain. And the way it works is the sodium potassium just rush in and out of the nerves to create the impulse. So if you've got a defect in this in one of the sodium channels, that markedly increases your sensitivity to pain. So what they found was that by using gene therapy, where they used an altered virus, they could block this entry, this rapid entry of sodium into the nerve, so it really damped down their sensation of pain. And it's been very, very successful in a mice studies. It hasn't been done in humans yet, but they're testing it in human cells with exactly the same response. So the next thing would be to take people with chronic pain, give them this gene therapy, and see if it helps their pain. Because a lot of people with peripheral neuropathy or pain, it's just not working what they're on at the moment.
And they just have to put up with it currently?
Absolutely.
Let me see. A risk of fatal heart attack may double in heat waves. Summer is just around the corner. We're told it's going to be one hell of a summer. And we talk about fine particle pollution days as well.
Yeah. And this is the reason, exactly what you just said then, mate. The reason why I wanted to bring this up is I think we're headed for a really vicious summer, where I think we're going to have a lot of days above 35 degrees Celsius. And this study out of China showed that if you had 4 days in a row where the pollution levels were at their highest level, they talk about 37.5 micrograms per cubic meter of this PM2.5, which is particulate matter 2.5. So basically, heavy pollution and really hot weather for a few days in a row, you double the risk for heart attack. So when people think about heart attacks, they think about cholesterol and blood pressure and cigarette smoking and diabetes, but I don't think about pollution and hot weather. So I think that the strong message here, especially for more vulnerable people, such as the elderly or people who have a high risk factor profile for heart disease or already had a bypass, a stent, a heart attack, on those days, please do nothing stupid. So I'll give you an example. I had a 78-year-old man who thought it was a good idea on a 45 degrees Celsius day to play singles tennis and then ended up with a stent in his arteries. Now, I mean, really, you've got to be sensible. So on the really hot days, don't go out and do heavy gardening. On the hot days or the very polluted days, don't go for a jog or for a heavy walk. Just do your exercise inside or just have a day off exercising. But please be careful during those times, because it's the extremes of heat, the extremes of pollution that can really cause problems. In the same study, they also looked at extremes of cold, which still had a slightly higher risk for heart attack, but nothing like the extremes of heat and pollution.
Last but not least, hearing aids may reduce dementia risk by nearly 50%. This has been a large study, large numbers were used, and it's sad but true. A lot of people don't bother to go and do anything about their hearing.
No, and this just highlights the importance of our senses. So people that have problems with hearing have a marked increased risk for dementia, and I think the reason is pretty obvious. You're not getting the stimulus. You need to stimulate, as Hercule Poirot would say, the little grey cells. And if the little grey cells aren't being stimulated, they just tend to atrophy. So it's like anything. If you don't exercise your muscles get weak. You must continue to exercise your brain. Now, if you're not getting the stimulus there from hearing, so please, if people are having problems with their hearing, go off and get it treated. And also, mate, something else that wasn't on the list that I wanted to bring up was this is breaking news from last week. Now, many times people talk about breakthroughs in medicine, and often you find out that they're no big deal at all. But I think this one is a big deal. And this was a study that came out of Los Angeles where they looked at a particular molecule called AOH1996. So you know it hasn't got a name, but it's still, the research is pretty rudimentary. But they took human cell lines of breast cancer, prostate cancer, brain cancer, ovarian cancer, cervical cancer, skin cancer, and lung cancer. And this molecule targets a variant of a particular gene that's absolutely critical to DNA replication and repair only in tumours. So it doesn't affect human cells at all. And across the board, targeting these different cancer cell lines, they killed the cancer cells and left the normal cells untouched. Now, it's now in phase one clinical trials in humans, and phase one means you've got to make sure it's safe. So, but it didn't cause any toxicity at all in the cell lines, so they want to see that it's safe in humans, and they might fast-track this, because I tell you, this could be a cure for many of our common cancers.
I read that article last week, Ross, and I thought to myself, are we seriously very, very close to being able to cure cancer? My goodness, what a day that would be if that was to happen.
Well, I think we are close. Interestingly, if you think about how we got entertainment 20 years ago, you'd go down to your local Blockbuster Video or Video Easy store and pick up a video and come home. They don't exist anymore. Why? Because we've progressed beyond that to now live streaming. And in the same way, people doing my job, cardiologists, and many of them are interventional, where they put in stents. I don't do stents myself. I'm a diagnostic preventative cardiologist. But these guys are putting in stents. They're talking about now a vaccination against heart disease.
Yeah.
So it could be that people like me, doing what we're doing at the moment, will be out of a job, and we've got to think about doing something different, because they may be curing heart disease, curing cancer. So I think we've got to move with the future of medicine, the trends we spoke about, nanotechnology before, the micropatch therapies, where instead of people being injected, because 10% of people are trypanophobes, which means they have a fear of injections.
And put your hand up, Brent.
Yeah, and a lot of those injections will now just be a patch on your arm. So we're moving towards that. So all vaccinations work better if they're a patch rather than an injection. A lot of people don't realise that. So we're moving to all of these new things in medicine. So the doctors practicing medicine at the moment will have to start changing their attitude, or they'll be out of a job.
Out of a job.
Yep.
I got to go to the news, and if I don't, I'll be out of a job. Always good to catch up with you, mate. We'll talk to you next Tuesday, Ross.
Good on you, mate. Lovely.
Thank you, mate. Lovely to talk to you too.